Hi, I'm Bill Teeple, and I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. Our guest today is Judy Bales, a longtime resident of Fairfield with a national reputation in the arts for her fiber arts, found object, metal, meshy, three-dimensional art sculptures. And I'm very fond of her work, and she has shown at Icon and at Gallery 51 East when it existed. She is doing public art, and this is something that we haven't talked about in the past with her. She has major public art commissions throughout the United States, one a couple down in the Arizona area, and others too. I'm going to let Donna's been itching to ask her some questions, so I'm going to let Donna go at her.
Well, you sort of jumped in with one of my questions, which was, how did you originally come to be doing these public art projects? When did that start, and what was the first one you did?
The first one I began was in Phoenix, Arizona. The first one I completed was here in Fairfield, the BNSF Trail Bridge, which is near Chautauqua Park. I got involved in public art about the year 2000, and the way it happened is that I did a private commission for a home in Iowa City in, I think, 1999. I mean, it was a large wall piece, and it was came up very quickly, and I had a deadline that was not long enough, but I, you know, was willing to do it, and I completed it, and the client liked it, and it was a project that really I just felt I could really sink my teeth into it, and it was challenging, and it was a much larger scale than I was used to working on, and I got paid a little better for it. I'd been working through the gallery system for many years, which is challenging and frustrating, and in general doesn't really mesh well with my philosophy of art anyway, because galleries basically are selling to people that can afford to buy the work. And I really, you know, I've always wanted my work to be accessible to anyone that is interested in the work. And yet, of course, as artists, we have to make a living. So I was really excited when I completed this private commission, and I started thinking that I'd like to try to get larger public commissions. And so I just started applying. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are arts commissions all over the country send out what are called requests for qualifications. When they have a project that comes up, they send out a call for artists to submit. And I started doing that on a regular basis, and I did it for about a year. And I just decided I was just going to keep at it, and not knowing how long it would take to get something. And very, very fortunately, after about a year, I was selected as a finalist for a project in Phoenix, and went down there for the interview. It was absolutely the scariest thing I've ever done in my life. Totally did not know what to expect to go in front of this panel, and luckily we did not have to do a proposal. They were choosing the artist based on how they said that they would approach the project, and that's sometimes they do that. Sometimes an arts commission will ask for an actual proposal. So,
what was the project specifically?
This was a pedestrian bridge, a pedestrian and bicycle bridge going over I-17 in Phoenix. And so it was just like, lo and behold, I got it. It was just, really kind of shocking to me. And again, even after I got it, it was totally very, very scary because I didn't know anything about bridges, didn't know anything about public art, but of course it was also the most exciting thing I had ever done. And then that project stretched out over, I think, 5 or 6 years, which they often do, and was completed in 06, I think, and is a project I'm really, really proud of. And in that, since then, you know, I've continued to apply for projects just constantly. For several years, I think I was probably applying to 3 or 4 a month. Mm-hmm. You know, so I've applied for hundreds over the years, and I'm chosen as a finalist usually, you know, a couple times a year, and then I don't always get those projects. You have to be really, really thick-skinned, and you just have to really believe in yourself and persevere in order to continue applying for these projects, because there are so many very, very qualified and experienced public artists out there, and so you're constantly, really constantly being rejected. But I have enough successes, you know, that it keeps me going. Although I will say that if I had not gotten that first commission, I've often said it's a little like gambling. If you win early on, that kind of makes you think, oh, I can do this, and it keeps you going. If you don't win for a long time, you're likely to give up, you know, early on. So if I had not gotten that first commission, there's a good chance that after maybe a few years of applying and never getting anything, that there's a good chance I would have given up. But because I got that early success, it has given me strength to just keep plunging ahead and looking at ways to get projects other than through just competitions, you know, working with engineering firms, working with architects, you know, working with our local trails council, all these many, you know, it's like there's, you know, a front door to get what you want, or there are many other doors that you can, mm-hmm. that you can get the type of projects or the type of work that you want.
Now, I just love the fact that you started applying for these things and you didn't even know anything about bridges and all. So what happens when you design a, you don't know anything about bridges, then do they provide you with engineers to work with? I mean, obviously it has to be structurally sound and all that. How do you coordinate your artistic impulses with all the other things that go into building something like that?
Yeah, and that this first project, over I-17 in Phoenix, was this absolutely amazing learning process for me. I've often thought to myself, it's kind of like getting a degree in public art, this one project, because it was so multi-layered. And it was, in fact, an artist-engineer collaboration. So the Arts Commission had selected an engineering firm for this project before they selected the artist. And so it's like an arranged marriage, you know, and that's what happens often. An engineer and artist, or architect and artist, or maybe landscape architect and artist, will be put together in these projects, not by choice. You know, they're chosen independently, and it can be incredibly successful, or it can at times be very disastrous, depending on how willing both of those entities on the design team, how open they are to working with the other and how respectful they are. Mm. Phoenix has a lot of, it's probably got 12 or 15 artist-designed pedestrian bridges or other bridges or highway bridges in Phoenix. And in some cases, and that was also very educational for me, because I'd make these trips down there and I had all of these artist-designed bridges that had been put up before me. So it was like I had this kind of textbook And at each level, and again, fortunately, this was, I got into this project at the very beginning, so the engineer had, he had determined that it would be a steel truss bridge, and that was all that had been decided. So everything beyond that, we were able to work on together. And some of the, if you view the bridges that are over the highways down there, in some cases it's obvious that the engineer did his job, his or her job, and the artist did his or her job, and then they put them together in this structure, and they weren't really, it wasn't really a collaborative process. And so I was very fortunate in that we did have a good working relationship, and I also did a lot of independent research myself on bridge history and bridge aesthetics, because I just, once I got that project, I just really, really became totally fascinated by bridge structures. And also, I think I got the project because my work before that had, I was doing these sculptures that were essentially cages. They were wire frames, and then I would wrap them with fabric, but they were cage-like. And this, because of highway regulations, this bridge was going to have a cover on it. Mm. And so I think that that's why, you know, so my work, even though it was small and didn't have anything to do with public art, did actually have a relationship to bridge structures. So there again, I never would have guessed that I would have been, I mean, 10 years ago, if anyone would have said I would be working with bridges, I would have completely thought it was an outrageous idea. But in retrospect, it's really been completely logical, a logical progression of my work.
Now, when you were, because this sort of pattern has, I think, come into play in talking about the bridges and your other work with metals and all that. When you were a kid, did you have that tendency to kind of plunge in before you knew what was going to happen and just move along with doing things to find out what would happen and to learn as you go and research as you go? Because that's a very, I think that's a wonderful quality for an artist to have.
I don't know if that was the way I worked or not.
We talked about learning from children. I bet you learned that one from the children.
Well, yeah, and you know, the one thing that stands out in my art training as a child is I remember looking in the encyclopedia. I mean, as a child, you know, I love to look through encyclopedias. I guess that's a pretty typical thing. But I can remember seeing some Greek statue of a horse, and I was so inspired. And I just thought, I can do that, you know. I want to be able to do that. And this story is going to tie in with art education for sure. But so what I did was I went out and I found a brick. And I went to the garage and I found my dad's woodworking tools and some kind of a mallet. And I attempted to, and my dad was great. I'm not going to say he beat me for, you know, for destroying his woodworking tools or anything. But I tried to carve.
He was clenching his teeth.
What's that?
Never mind. Go ahead.
I tried to carve this horse out of this brick with woodworking tools, and I was so frustrated and just felt like I can never be an artist. This is awful. I can't do anything. And, you know, looking back, I think, boy, the last thing you do as an art teacher is give a child something that's going to give them that kind of frustration. Of course, I gave it to myself. But, you know, you give a child a piece of soapstone or clay or something where they have this experience of success rather than this awful experience of failure. So that's my story.
Yeah, that was
how
it.
I worked to
but,
the
but
child.
But it kind of does answer my question, because you actually did plunge in before you knew whether it was going to work or not.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And you learned that you can't carve a brick with woodworking tools. Right. So it was a learning experience. So. Yeah,
right.
That's cool.
Right.
But you did talk in a previous interview we did with you about being kind of tight as an artist, mm-hmm. and you had to break out of that, and what sort of like broke you out was watching the inventiveness of children and their natural creativity, which actually diminishes with time. You mentioned to us that as they grow up and learn how to do things right and stuff, this free exploration diminishes.
Right. Well, and then to come full circle with that, in the going to college in the 70s, I did get broken out of that tightness because everything was abstract expressionism and so I got, and that was good. I mean, it got me out of that tightness and then got me into more exploration along with other things. And then my fiber work has been very much, the theme is very much exploration and innovation with materials and that type of thing. But for so many years, that's been so fully my involvement with art that then working on something like a bridge structure where, although I'm the artist and there is an engineer and it's not like I have to do anything that actually involves a structure. I mean, they translate what I'm doing. That's the way these projects are set up. But you at least have to make a drawing that, you know can be scaled or that, I mean, you have to have a basic understanding of reading or interpreting engineering drawings and that type of thing. And I'm so right-brained now. Is that the right side? Yeah. So my work has been so right-brained, and that's just the way I'm used to thinking for so many years, that it's been equally positive for me to. It's been equally positive for me to work to go back to having to fit into these parameters that involve my left brain. And it's sometimes as if I almost literally can feel, the two sides of my brain kind of screeching back toward the middle because I've been so free for so long that it's been a very, very positive thing for me to have to balance that or rebalance that a little bit with something that's more structured and rigid. And I actually love having these parameters to work in. And I often find that is the most creative way for me to work now, because if I have too many, if possibilities are just completely limitless, then you don't really have, it's like the sand that starts the pearl in the oyster. You don't have anything that kind of starts your, starts that gem of the artwork. And so by having parameters to work within, I find that's a very creative process for me, and I enjoy that tremendously.
Yeah, I think I can totally relate to that too. Just that there's too many, if there's too many ideas, you don't know where to start.
Right.
And I'd like to kind of, before the end of the show, mention a little bit about your inspiration with African American quilting.
Why don't you mention who we're talking to?
Oh, yes,
for the
we're talking
who
to Judy
in.
Bales. We've been talking to fiber artist Judy Bales during the show, and she's been talking about her public art in this show, and she gave a program on one of our Icon Odd Thursdays on African American quilting and how that's influenced some of your fiber work too. And what you were just saying about this blend of being right-brained and sort of free-form and yet having a structure, I think mm-hmm. is very relevant to the form of African American quilting, where they use a pattern, but there's something so improvisational right. about it. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and African American quilts, I think over the years, since the mid-70s, they have been, it's another of those things where I felt such an affinity for them that they both are just are, the working methods of those artists are very much like my working methods, but in turn they have influenced my work for many years. And basically, African-American quilts relate to jazz in that they're improvisational in nature, and the artists do, and this is Afro-traditional, it's not that African-American artists don't do the traditional quilts that we know, but there is a particular a style that has been very prevalent over the years. And the same way that a standard quilt might start with a particular quilt block and then in a very systematic way that quilt pattern is repeated throughout the quilt. That's one method of working. But in the Afro-traditional quilts, they will start with the same the very same quilt pattern, but they will vary it throughout the quilt. So it is structured. It's not that it's just a crazy quilt or free form. There's definitely a structure, but it's improvisational in nature. And there's more of there's not such an emphasis on precise measuring or repetition as there are in standard quilt making, and that's what I felt such an affinity for, was just this kind of freedom. You have a basic pattern or idea, but within that you expand and you just change it every time it's repeated. And this does seem to be and of course the Afro-American quilts, there's been much research that shows that these methods of working are directly passed down from the African, and African cultures seem to an exceptionally high degree honor innovation or improvisation. Most cultures have some improvisation in their art, but it's especially prevalent within African cultures and within African-American cultures. So, and those were, I mentioned in the last talk that we had, that I just made a trip to Washington, D.C. to visit museums, and there was an absolutely stunning exhibit quilts by an African-American quilt maker, Rosie Lee Tompkins, mm-hmm. that was at the Museum of Women in the Arts, American Museum of Women in the Arts.
Well, when you gave your presentation here, it totally made me just want to go home and cut up fabric. Because I made a quilt one time and I hated the measuring part and the precision part and the fact that you could do it with just, you know, and it could be crooked and all, but mm-hmm. it all just, it was so exciting. These patterns were so exciting. If anybody is curious about what they look like, you can go on the web and, you know, just Google African American quilts and you can look at pictures of these things. But they are wall art, you know, you could use them on your bed, but they're totally exciting works of abstract art, and they definitely feel like jazz. If you saw the cut paper works that Matisse did that he called jazz, that were very famous, and you can pretty much hear the music in the colors and the forms when you look at these. And the African American quilts were the same way. You could just hear the rhythms and the syncopation and all of that. Right.
And they're very much like paintings. I mean, they're and when you read interviews with these quilters, the way they talk about them, and many times they're quilters that grew up in they're definitely not art educated, you know, they may have grown up in very poor families, but the way they talk about their process is very painterly in nature, and just an ongoing source of inspiration for me. They have been, and I have had a strong desire also to research more about these quilts and learn about the influences or discover where the influences came from throughout the generations. And I'm sure that if I'm able to, been trying to get funding to do some research, and I'm sure that that will add yet another layer. By researching that, it will continue to inform my own work.
Now, have you actually made an African-American quilt, or have you made other kinds of projects that kind of leapt off the inspiration of those quilts?
No, I used to make quilts. They were always small quilts. They'd be crib quilts that I'd give to friends that had, were having babies. It was kind of an excuse to make a little quilt. And I only once, I think, have I made a full-size quilt, just because I don't have the perseverance for that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, because I do love fabric. I mean, I do work with metals and with other materials other than, actually fiber materials in my work. But I do love fabric itself, and I do love to sew. And I just don't enjoy the precision and the exact measuring as much as mm-hmm. as is usually thought of in sewing.
I'd like you to curate a show here of, I don't know what we can get, because that stuff is really highly regarded now, but even if we had secondary artists or from the South or something working, it'd be fun to curate to have a show here.
Well, I would love that. And when I did give my talk, I believe Karen Harris brought an African-American quilt that she owns. And so there, I think there would be many resources that we could pull together.
Let's talk about it.
I'm getting
excited.
I'd love that.
The thought of it. We've been interviewing Judy Bales. This is KRU-FM LP, 100.1 FM. And it's so fun to talk to you about all these things. She's got so many avenues of her artistic life.
We could easily do 10 interviews with you and not run out of material. So thank you so much.
Here. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Judy.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.